In the studio this morning, I have Jim Salinger. Jim Salinger is an Auckland-based climate change scientist who formerly worked with the New Zealand Crown Research Institute, NIWA, National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research. He was the lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 for their efforts to build up and disseminate greater knowledge about man-made climate change and to lay the foundations for the measures that are needed to counteract such change. In 2006, Jim Salinger was elected to the position of President of the Commission for Agricultural Meteorology at the World Meteorological Organization. And I wish to say kia ora and thank you very much, Jim, for coming to the program.
Maureen, delighted to.
Jim, how serious is climate change and what CO2 is doing to the oceans and atmosphere?
Well, it is a very serious issue because it's basically about the survival of us as a species on this planet. The planet will always go on, whether we're here or not, is the planet won't have feelings on. And why it's a big issue is that what we're looking at over the 21st century, there's increasing evidence that says if we don't stop releasing greenhouse gases from fossil fuels and deforestation and also increased agricultural activities, whatever they might be, the planet is going to warm. And there are all sorts of estimates now, but the Hadley Centre recently published a paper saying 3 to 4 degrees by 2060, and the new evidence that's coming out is we're looking at 1 to 2 metre sea level rise this century. So that's going to inundate huge population areas in the Asian mega deltas. If we look at, for example, there's the Ganges and Bangladesh at the bottom of that, Vietnam, and in China, there are all these highly populated mega-deltas, and of course you get the flood coming down the river plus sea level rise, and that means that there's going to be a whole lot of people that are going to have to relocate. So very much there's increasing, the science is becoming more solid every day that global warming is here, is taking off, and we need to do something about it to ensure our future on this planet.
Yeah, Jim, there's a contention that the media is muddying the waters by giving the same amount of coverage to the so-called sceptics, that the population is now becoming more confused and not seeing climate change as an important issue, really.
Yes, and I'm very alarmed by this, but it's unfortunately some media, because the BBC will not run the sceptical view, and I call it a denialist view, because all scientists are sceptics by our nature. And if we look at climate change science, and if I was to ask, is the science settled, I'd say that's a stupid question. In terms of the theory of do greenhouse gases cause climate to warm, yes, that is pretty well settled. And Arrhenius about 1900 worked out if you doubled carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you got a few degrees warming, and the IPCC's refined this down. But the estimates are much the same, whether it's the IPCC or... So this has been a solid fact, so basis physics. But, for example, what do clouds do to climate? We know high clouds, warm climate. We know low clouds, cool climate. And if you get more of each, so scientists will still be sceptical on what the actual effects of clouds are in climate. So all scientists are sceptics. Where it comes in is that you get a huge body, 2,500 scientists in the IPCC, who are climate scientists, have said, yes, climate change is a fact and it's due to human activities. And then you get a few other people who may not necessarily be climate scientists. I mean, I'm not an expert on genetic modification or genetic engineering. So my opinion on that is going to be worth the same as a person in the street. Certainly I've done biochemistry and zoology and botany, so I might have a slightly better understanding, but I'm not at the forefront of that science. So for other people to weigh in and say, oh, there's a debate, is really misrepresenting the situation. It's like, in sports term, the All Blacks rugby team playing the Ponsonby Patong Club at rugby. That's really what we're looking at. And I call the people that bring the other view denialists, because they're not being sceptical. The basic science has been proved, as well as it's going to be. This group of people, they're like the smoking lobby. They take a very denialist attitude, their behaviour, and they take certain facts out of context, quote them, and of course the public are confused, and that's their deliberate intention to confuse the public, that, well, in fact, there's a debate, and, you know, and, oh, it was warmer 1,300 years ago. In fact, they take facts totally out of context and use them. For example, the fact that 1998 was the warmest year, then they will take temperatures at night, 2007, oh, they say, well, the planet's cooling. Well, you can't take short-term temperature trends. You've got to look at trends of 50 years or more. And I harp back to my statistics teacher. He was always quoting from this book called Daryl Huff, How to Lie with Statistics. So the denialists are continually lying with statistics. They're using their cherry-picking data, they're selectively quoting, and the science in terms of greenhouse gases causing climate to warm, and that humans produce greenhouse gases, therefore humans are causing the planet to warm, that's beyond any question at all.
Because, Jim, the scientists who are doing the climate research, of course, are earth scientists, and these scientists are not to be confused with, as you say, ordinary scientists who are industrial, commercial, or military scientists.
Exactly.
And yet these are the ones who are signing these big petitions, yes, saying that climate change doesn't exist. And, of course, everybody thinks, well, if 30,000 scientists can sign this petition, then they must be right. And I think we have to be really, really clear what are earth scientists and what...
And climate scientists, exactly.
That's right, because, you see, why is it that earth scientists are not stating clearly that they are the ones who are doing the climate research, and that the population has to better understand them as against listening to all these journalists and radio talkback hosts? This is, I think, quite frustrating for everybody.
I think it's probably people don't appreciate the understanding of science and science degrees, where, in fact, you specialise at a very early time. Now, I did a BSc in physical geography, in which there was climate in there, but when I did my PhD, my doctorate, it was entirely on climate science. So I became a world expert, in the sense, on the climate and climate change in New Zealand. So scientists are quite narrow in their speciality, and this is the point. And you have to look at where the scientist is specialised in, or where their credentials are. And that's why I use the illustration, whether genetic modification of corn or whatever, my opinion there is just as good as an intelligent journalist or layperson. Because I'm a scientist does not qualify me to come out with strong statements on the benefits of genetic engineering or not. But I spent sort of 10 years getting highly qualified in climate science. That's where I am an expert, and that's where my scientific peers in climate science are well qualified on. And I think, yes, we do need to publicise the fact that the people that should be listened to, sure, you can question the science, and it's healthy to be sceptical, that's fine, but the people that are the best qualified are those that are climate scientists, because they understand the climate system.
Now, from a global perspective, the New Zealand government's NIWA, the National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research, would be staffed, of course, by excellent scientists.
Yes, they are.
And that they have contributed also to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, receiving the Nobel Prize in 2007. How many of them are actually involved here in New Zealand with climate change, and what urgency do you see in educating the New Zealand population to become far more conscious and embrace the changes needed to face the oncoming environmental challenges?
Well, firstly, there's excellent climate scientists in NIWA, and I had the honour of working with a lot of them. And I think about 10, plus or minus a few, were involved in receiving the, in a sense, we all contributed to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. So my colleagues there have done excellent work. Now, in terms of urgency, yes, it's very urgent. And if you look in terms of one area of research I was involved with was the snow and ice monitoring program, and our glaciers used to have 100 cubic metres of snow and ice over New Zealand. Now we're down to about 45 cubic kilometres of snow and ice. In other words, we've lost over half our Southern Alps ice cover since about 1900. So this shows you the environmental changes that have been going on in the alpine environment. And this is just merely about a 1 degree centigrade
shift.
Warming.
Mm-hmm.
So what this shows is if we're looking at 3 or 4, the environment is going to face huge challenges. So really what needs to happen is our leaders need to get on board and look at something like 40% emissions reductions targets by 2020 and 80% by 2050, and only then do we have a 50-50 chance of keeping global warming at 2 degrees.
Because NIWA stands for water and atmospheric elements.
Yes.
And what about the soils and the microorganisms, Jim? Aren't these also the drivers of life?
Yes, they certainly are.
Bacteria, fungi and algae, yes?
Yes, and if we go to the oceans as a good example, it's obviously the algae there, the blue-green algae in the oceans, are at the bottom of the food chain. And this is where you then have all the filter feeders, whether they are whales or crustaceans, will feed on the algae and then turn them into animal biomass. And they are incredibly important. And I think we need to look at the oceans because they contain about 2/3 of the area of this planet, and they are warming also, but more alarmingly the pH is going down, it's becoming more acidic, and as soon as that happens it means the algae that have calcium carbonate shells, they start dissolving, and so you start affecting the whole plant biomass in the oceans, which will then affect all the food chain. So the fact that our oceans are becoming more acidic, it's gone down 0.1 of a pH point, expected to go down a 0.2, because as carbon dioxide gets into the oceans, it gets far more acidic, you get more carbonic acid. And this is going to really affect life in our oceans, which is basically, let's face it, life all started in the oceans, and that's going to then impact on the food chains.
Serious stuff. With the previous Labor government, they were perceived as pretty slow on the uptake of environmental issues, but they did get on board for their second term by talking up sustainability and putting climate change on the agenda. However, the National government, who is a business-oriented government, have in many ways reneged on sustainability and is perceived as dragging the chain with regard to Copenhagen and sustainability. Have you any thoughts on that?
Well, certainly we've been trying to encourage through the Sign On campaign with people that are well known as well to encourage this government. And this is why we want John Key to go to Copenhagen, because it's only the leaders that can really make a difference. They can go there, they can take decisions, whereas if you've got ministers there, if it's Minister Grosser and Nick Smith, they'll have to refer any decisions back to Wellington anyway if they're significant. So it's only the likes of them, and it appears that there's a good chance of Barack Obama being there because he'll be receiving his Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo in Norway, which is nearby. Certainly a lot of the European governments are there. It looks very likely Kevin Rudd will be there. And so these are our major trading partners. It would be very sensible for John Key to be there rather than, as I see it at the moment, our administration seems to be staggering around, responding to all sorts of pressures, whether it's from the Maoris or the farmers or business or whatever. And at the moment, there have been several good economics pieces written on the emissions trading scheme. It's basically taxpayer pays, and a huge bill at that. $110 billion apparently, as the Select Committee's estimated, is what it's going to cost future taxpayers of New Zealand. This is not very equitable because it's really the polluter should be paying, not the taxpayer of New Zealand. So it's those that are using carbon and producing carbon dioxide from it that should be paying.
Do you feel that the government is really up to speed on this? Is there a real desire to want to lead? Because New Zealand, we're in the top five per head of population on our planet as greenhouse gas producing, and yet we are major planetary polluters.
Yes.
Should we not be at the top leading as well?
Yes, well, and this administration has come out very strongly to say they want to be fast followers rather than leaders. Well, as far as I can see, they're not fast followers. They're staggering behind. And when, in fact, we try and promote this clean, green image, and we're not, in the sense of how we're handling this issue. So it will be interesting. It'll be our trade partners that actually pull us into line because they'll start refusing to trade with us, particularly on these issues, if all the others like USA and Australia in particular start getting on our board. And if China joins in, I think we have to.
I'm speaking with Jim Salinger on climate change and what we as a humanity here in New Zealand need to do. Scientists are increasingly seeing our planet as a tightly coupled web of relationship that meshes all disciplines within science. Earth system science is now becoming a new understanding of how we see the Earth, and of course climatologists are starting to see this as well because everything's interlinked. Do you see more and more interdisciplinary relationships happening?
Oh yes, because I think we only have to look at how climate models have modelled the climate system to see what's happening. When we were looking at how climate might change in the late 70s, the climate models were very physical, sort of laws of airs of motion and a few greenhouse gases, and experiments would just put in carbon dioxide and see what the climate response would be. Then, through time, an ocean was added, and then more greenhouse gases were added. Then sulfate aerosols were added. Then, although land was in there, and I should say the oceans in early times were described as a swamp model. In other words, it was just water that sat about. Now you have a fully coupled ocean atmosphere model. You've got ocean circulation, you've got climate circulation in the atmosphere. And now what's happening is you're getting land services in and you're getting land cover in terms of whether it's dark or light or whether it's desert or ice. And what is being added now is certainly the chemical processes in the atmosphere, and then they're starting to add in the life processes. So I think if you just trace the development of climate models and how they're becoming more complex and having all sorts of feedbacks, biological, chemical, the oceans in it. This really illustrates how we're looking at a planetary system rather than just specific elements of it. And so in the end, when we want to get answers, we are getting more and more sophisticated climate models. Mind you, the computing power is allowing us to do this simply because computers now are very fast, have huge amounts of memory, so we can now do this. If it was back in 1970, no, the computers weren't capable of doing this. So we're no longer limited by computers.
Because in 2001, 1,400 Earth scientists signed the Amsterdam Declaration that the Earth system behaves as a single, self-regulating system comprised of physical, chemical, and biological plus human components.
Exactly.
And so this is what's happening. It's a build-up of seeing Earth as nearly like a holistic system.
Yep.
And so is this word holistic becoming more and more?
Oh, yes. Well, yes, it's the Gaia idea, or it's just basically the biosphere. And so that's the atmosphere and oceans and thin mantle of the surface as a wholly integrated system. And this is exactly how it has to be looked at, because it all interacts with each other, and as soon as you change one component, well, in this case, pushing a whole lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, you're going to affect a whole range of aspects of the Earth atmosphere system. So it is a combined system, and we have to look at the atmosphere, the land surface and the oceans. And obviously, as well as the physical side, you have to look at the biological activities and all in the air, the oceans and on land.
This solar system, the sun has a certain influence on the fact that the planet every 6 months turns away from the sun
and
towards the sun. And of course, this is a big challenge when you have all the white of the snow disappearing in the northern ice cap and the water really starting to, because it's darker, starting to absorb a lot of the heat and warm up. Because we've noticed down here in the Hauraki Gulf in New Zealand, we are getting mahi-mahi, and mahi-mahi is a fish from Hawaii, and also up in north, Wailu, in the Bay of Islands. We're getting fish there. So obviously from the equator towards the Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn, this water mass is actually warming up so that fish are starting to move in a greater area?
Yes, well, what happens with fish in fisheries or fish stocks, it's very interesting because they don't have any land boundaries, and they will migrate to where the environment is best at them. And we see this when El Ninos, when you have collapse of the anchovy fisheries, and that had a whole lot of knock-on effects off South America. So fisheries and fish don't have any national boundaries or fences which they can't. So they just move within the oceans. And what is being observed is more subtropical species are moving towards the equator. The temperate species, obviously, in the North Pacific and North Atlantic are now starting to get into the Arctic Ocean. And fish move around very freely, and they'll go into the environment which best suits, shall we say, their thermal range and what they're best adapted to. So there's studies showing now that there has been, like off the California coast, there has been changes in fisheries from more temperate type species to more subtropical species, and the temperate ones are moving north. So there are some studies that are starting to well document what's happening to fish species in particular.
Are fish not then canaries in the coal mine?
Yes, because the fish species, as I said, are not restrained in the oceans. They can move about and they will go to the environment that suits them the best. Of course, we have overfishing of fish stocks, particularly in the North Atlantic, and that affects the dynamics as well. But if you leave that alone, in other words, don't affect that, then the fish will move around to the environment that suits them the best.
So with migratory birds, say like the godwit, is the godwit leaving New Zealand later because it's warmer in this country, and when it gets up to, say, Siberia or Alaska, because it's warmer up there, they may stay up there longer? Has there been any
I'm not aware of studies done in New Zealand, but Dr. Terry Root at Stanford in California has looked at migrations of bird species within North America, and certainly they're laying their eggs earlier. The migrations are earlier in terms of spring. So over 30 years, there's been about a 10-day change in bird behaviour, whether it's laying eggs or migrations or what. So what might used to happen at the 30th of April in the northern spring now happens about the 15th of April. So there's been a change in dates of a lot of species in terms of when they do things in the year from various studies done there.
And what about heat islands, that cities now becoming so large, particularly if you have a look at the coast down from Shanghai, Beijing, around that area, around the Yokohama, Tokyo area, and also along the east coast from New York, all that area is warming up. There's lots of lights going on and all the business.
Sure. Yes, so what you're doing is you're replacing a vegetative surface with concrete, and obviously people will be heating buildings. The main effect is more at night. In particular, you get the urban heat island effect, that in the centre of a city, and the early studies in London showed that it was about 5 to 10 degrees warmer. This is on a night with clear skies and calm conditions than maybe in the rural areas surrounding. And this is a well-established fact, but this is really the difference between having concrete in an urban environment compared with a rural environment. So, in a sense, this isn't global warming. This is just changing the surface and putting in buildings, concrete structures. Obviously, there's going to be energy consumed to keep housing people warm, and so the outside temperature is going to be a lot warmer than out in a rural environment.
But does this combined heat warm up the planet in some way?
Or just it may do, but I think the important change is the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We've got about 40% more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere now than we had before the Industrial Revolution, and 70% of the carbon dioxide that's been emitted into the global atmosphere has been emitted in the last 2 to 3 decades. That's a huge amount.
Because the vegetation on the Earth has worked it out or evolved to such a degree that they wanted only about 180 parts per million to, say, 240 parts per million of CO2 in the gas. And that's how vegetation has worked for millions of years.
Yes.
And so if increase it suddenly, all of a sudden there's a huge infusion of CO2. And I've heard that some pine trees that grow now, they're growing faster, but they haven't got the strength. They're nowhere near as strong.
Yes, I'm probably not such an expert in pine trees and whether they're strong. Certainly, carbon dioxide does stimulate photosynthesis, and so you'd expect if carbon dioxide is higher in the atmosphere, you get more photosynthesis, and that's the build-up of plant sugars and plant structures, and therefore you'd expect that to go a bit faster. In terms of the strength of pine trees, I'm not an expert there.
I'm just working with the idea that it's like giving babies a whole lot of junk food or hamburgers, expecting them to grow big and fat.
Well, it could well be, but as I said, I'm not up with the science in that area.
I understand. Jim, can I come back to the fact is that here in Auckland at the moment, I'm gardening and we're not getting the rain that I want. And I have a sneaky idea that we'll be getting less and less rain over the last few years here in Auckland because the ground is dry and there's some big shifts happening in our local weather patterns.
Right. Well, what we've had certainly at the last part of the 20th century, what we've found is that there have been more westerly winds across New Zealand and more anticyclones across northern New Zealand. So what has been happening is northern New Zealand and the east of the North Island has got drier, certainly in the latter parts of the 20th century. And so that certainly has been happening. Climate models do indicate a strengthening of the westerly circulation over New Zealand. So this with increased greenhouse gases. So the signal here we see is consistent with what we'd expect, but it's probably too early to say that this is a global warming signal. But the other thing that happens is when the climate warms up, you'll get more evapotranspiration, which is moisture lost from the ground, so that's evaporation from the ground and transpiration by plants, and it means it will dry out faster.
Yes, there's a concern, of course, around weather forecasting too. Over the last few weeks, we have had weather forecasters state that we're going to get good rain, and yet here in this northern part of, say, from Auckland up, we're not getting this rain. Is it because we haven't got enough data collecting areas over a more vast area for them to get the information to discern what is happening?
Oh, I see. No, I think it's more in the sense we are in the El Nino weather pattern. That does make it drier in northern and eastern areas of New Zealand and wetter in the south and west. So, in a sense, one would expect this season there have been good rains in the east of the North Island, certainly in September, October, but one would expect it for this summer anyway to be drier in northern, eastern areas of New Zealand, simply in terms that we're in an El Nino climate cycle at the moment.
How long is this cycle expected to last?
Well, it certainly will last to the first quarter of 2010, and what happens after that we'll just have to see. But this is a seasonal pattern, so it goes from about 3 months to 12 months. And climate scientists will be monitoring this carefully.
Jim, as you're a specialist with glaciers, the Fox Glacier and the Franz Josef Glacier, what is their status at present?
Well, they're retreating a little bit, but they're not good indicators of the whole glacier climate of the Southern Alps because they're like tubes of toothpaste. And you just put a little bit of pressure on one end and out squirts a whole lot of ice and you release the pressure and it sucks it back. So they're very responsive glaciers. You need to look at the whole mass of the Southern Alps. And that's what I was involved in the NIWA program, which has been going for 30 years, in which each summer we looked at what the annual gain or loss of snow mass was, but then you have to look at the big glaciers, and there's about 12 of those which are downwasting in the Southern Alps. These are ones like the Tasman, the Mueller, the Hooker, and they're still losing ice very rapidly. So the Fox and Franz, they're iconic and they're fast responding, but they're not necessarily a clear indicator of what's happening to our total ice mass over the Southern Alps.
Does it matter if the glacier is facing north as against facing south? Because if it's facing north, it's going to have more sunlight bearing down on it, whereas it's facing south, it'll be less?
Yes, well, what this means is when you're flying along the Southern Alps, which we have done in our glacier surveys, there's not much snow and ice on the northern sides, and it tends to be more on the southern sides, except in those areas where you have high mountains, and that's obviously the Mount Cook area. But when you get into the Fiordland area and the mountains are lower, then you'll be looking more at the southern faces rather than the northern faces of the mountains for snow and ice.
I'm speaking with Jim Salinger on climate change and what we need to do to be able to awaken New Zealanders to encourage our government to be more involved in embracing positive and sustainable ways. Jim, we also had this situation where the denialists or sceptics were able to hack into the system over in England regarding emails between scientists. Can you explain a little more about
this? Yes,
well,
what appears to have happened, they've got into the climatic research units a server somewhere on the University of East Anglia, and they've got a whole lot of emails. There's some from me included, because I obviously work with these people. And what they've done is they've got into conversations between all of us where we're discussing about work we're doing and papers we're putting together. And as you do, it's a bit like because my colleagues are in the United Kingdom, I'm not going to pick up the phone and talk to them because that's going to be very expensive and emails are more convenient. So amongst scientists, and we've done this for 20 years now, we've had internet for 20 years, we usually discuss out about the work we're doing, and if we're putting a paper together, we'll discuss that also. And when we do that, we're just exploring ideas and questioning things, because all scientists are skeptics anyway, and then we'll put a paper together. Now, it's the paper that's important, and it's the paper that's published after it's gone through peer review it's important. And what these hackers have done is, it seemed to be, it's like the smoking lobby during the 20th century, who wanted to tell people that, well, smoking wasn't bad for your health. And it's exactly the same thing. They will take information totally out of context and requote it, and it doesn't mean anything. It's just we're chatting away, throwing ideas around. So, and of course, as scientists, we'll be examining all aspects, and some of our emails will say sceptical things, but what's going to be the important conclusion is what has come through the peer-reviewed literature. The other thing I must say, it's a violation of people's privacy too, because, well, I know they've got emails from me to colleagues at Climatic Research Unit. I'm not concerned about the emails they've got, but according to the University of East Anglia website, there's a whole lot of personal emails, and I think that's disgraceful what they've done. It just shows you what people will stoop to try and muddy the science. Here we have top scientists, and the only way people can get at them is to try and look at all their emails, which are just conversations, people throwing ideas around, and at times we'll be quite sceptical, but because we're testing with ourselves. And then they're taken out of context, as one of them has done, where a colleague says the trick to this is looking at such and such data. He wasn't meaning a trick in a deceptive way, it's meaning the way you do it. And so, and you have to know the people, and I know my scientific colleagues very well, so I'd understand the meaning of how someone has expressed something. Now, if this is taken out of context, which it has, then people put other interpretations on it. So it's another, shall we say, attempt by the climate denialists to muddy the waters. Now, I call them denialists because they're not sceptics. They're taking a definite position against the overwhelming weight of evidence. Scepticism is healthy, denialist is not.
What is their reasoning? Why are they so vocal?
Well, it's interesting, and George Monbiot has written a piece in The Guardian about this. It appears they seem to be older members of the community, that if you're facing death, and not that climate change is death, but or you're facing something that is more immediate, you try and wipe it from your mind. Because George Monbiot is saying, well, the evidence for climate change is becoming more and more solid with every day, yet the public perception of its importance as an issue in the US has gone down from 71% to 57%. And it's certainly, it's a very difficult issue, but we do have to confront it. Well, we don't have to confront it, but whether we have a future as a species on this planet will be an interesting question.
Recently, I sent a letter to the Royal Society down in Wellington.
Yes, yes.
Which, of course, is the governing body of all the scientists. And I asked the question, really, the scientists themselves, because they see the challenge, why can't they take $2,000 out of their own pockets and put a big DVD together? I mean, you've got Weta Studios, who could do an excellent job, and none of them are short of a dollar.
Yes.
And that way,
Yes.
That's another contribution.
Yep.
And it gets really, really clear, and I'm sure they could do that. And every scientific group, be it in Australia or be it in America or England, could do the same, so that you would have 10 versions of essentially everyone being on the same page. That's, the vernacular would be just slightly different.
Yes, and that's a good idea. I know that there have been quite a lot of documentaries done, but it wouldn't hurt to do more, and it wouldn't do any harm in more and more scientists giving talks, because I think we have to be out into the public explaining it, because we're the best people to explain it. And also, I take the view that quite a lot of the scientists comes from the public purse, therefore we have an ethical duty to communicate in very clear terms with the public about our science. So I think all this is frightfully important. The resources are required, but again, getting back to the denialists, they have a lot of resources behind them and to put out the information. And the other thing is, they also want to tie us up defending our positions as well, and that stops us getting on with the science. So there's quite a lot of issues behind this.
Because there's two things. There's one, where are they getting their finance? And the other thing is, we've got a number of media, Paul Henry and Leighton Smith, who carry a huge audience with them.
Yes.
Why is it that they cannot be brought to a briefing where over a period of 2 or 3 or 4 hours, they are given a full understanding instead of the snippets that they're reading out to the public?
Well, certainly some media commentators you'll never change, and I'd fit them into the denialist camp. So they're not going to change at all. But I'd say it's dishonest of them, because it was like Garth George had me on about my expertise. I did respond. The Herald has not printed it. But I was accused of being a patronising PhD, and then he then quotes a whole lot of Australian Greenhouse Science Coalition, in other words, 40% of his article is not his own work, so talk about plagiarism. Garth George must take the cake. And then he takes me on in my own science and gets it patently wrong about the glaciers, with this little snippet, oh, the Franz and the Fox are increasing. Well, as I explained earlier, you have to look at the total Southern Alps. So you get these media commentators who put them above themselves, above the scientist who's got the qualifications, who's working in the area. And so I think it's part of the New Zealand tall poppy syndrome, and everybody has an opinion, therefore even if it's a quacky idea, it should be listened to.
Where do you think the future is going?
In terms of?
Of climate change and what's happening to the planet in relationship to the people awakening to what needs to be done.
Okay, well, firstly, there's no doubt about it. The climate is warming, and it's likely we'll probably see more than 2 degrees. What we all need to do, and I was taught at an early age, if you will it, it is no dream. So we need to make rapid changes and important changes in our lifestyles, how we consume fossil fuels, how we use energy and energy efficiencies. It's all very important, and very important to do now. And I think I'll quote the words of Mahatma Gandhi, whatever you will do is insignificant, but it's significant that you do it. And then I'd add to that, we need a vision, and this is where I get to, if you will it, it is no dream. We need to look at 40% emissions reductions target by 2020. It's very important we set that target, because then that's the vision. If you've got a vision, then, and if your will is strong enough, you will get there. And people have laid out what we need to do to get to 40% reductions. And New Zealand can get there, but every sector, from agricultural to business to transport to households, needs to do their part. So if everybody does their part, it's quite possible. So that's what we need to do. If we don't, we're going to see a lot of warming of this planet. And although New Zealand's fortunate in that the warming that occurs over New Zealand's a bit less than anywhere else, the impacts on our trading partners and the impacts in other areas of the world, you just take the impacts on the oceans, are going to be dramatic, and they will in turn affect New Zealand dramatically.
And the future of our children?
Well, we aren't giving them a good legacy, and that's why I've been working in this area for 30 years, in the hope to say, well, at least I've tried to make a difference. They are going to inherit our legacy, and which is a bit unfortunate, but that's why I think we have to try and do for our children and grandchildren, for their futures, we have to just try as hard as possible and as soon as possible.
And is there a leader who, other than our own inner guidance, to take us there, or do basically everybody has to make that effort?
We have to have good leadership. I think we need to watch Barack Obama very carefully, because US has changed significantly. We do need good leaders in New Zealand as well, but again, the groundswell also has to come from civil society. So that means all of us. And again, it's Mahatma Gandhi, what we each will do is insignificant, but it's significant that we do it. It's a bit like we all pay taxes. Now, the taxes you and I pay, in terms of New Zealand's tax take, are insignificant, but everybody does it, because you have to have, I guess, money to run the country on. And if everybody doesn't contribute, then you won't have it. So it's like paying taxes. We have to do it.
Very good. Jim, thank you so much for coming in and sharing of your expertise and experience.
You're very welcome.